G'day folks, Dan Gold. Welcome to the Long Property Show. Today I'm joined by none other than John McGrath. Very exciting. John, how are you going this morning?
G'day Dan. Well, look, I've had a better week because I've had bronchitis for the last week, so I'm hoping that I'll be able to get through the podcast so without coughing all over your listeners. But no, really, really good. Getting to the end of the year, I think for most property owners and people in property, it's been a pretty good year. A lot of the Australian market, certainly the East Coast, has been performing particularly well. So, I mean, a long year, but a good year.
Fantastic, John. It's funny. I've been meaning to get you on the podcast for so long. I've listened to every one of your podcasts almost twice. And the 1 week we're able to tee up the time, you've got the bronchitis. So just trust my luck. But still very, very appreciative of your time. And we've obviously got some questions to go through. We'll try and knock them off in 20 minutes. But, I mean, it has been a busy year. Home stretch now for 2017. What's on the agenda for you and your business between now and the end of the year?
Look, I think if you're in residential real estate, I think that you've got right through to Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve almost to complete your transactions for this year. I think that there are plenty of buyers out there that have been disappointed during the year that would love to be set before the year's out. So, we've certainly had our agents focusing on, right through to when they take their annual leave, just recognising that December is still a great month to sell and a great month to buy.
Yeah. And then, you've been talking about it on your podcast the last couple of weeks, that the way you end 2016 could very well dictate how your 2017 ends up going for you.
Well, that's right. I think that's a part of life, isn't it? The way you finish off a day or a month or a year is often how you start the next day, month or year. So I think it's really important that people, get their head around that fact and have a great holiday. We're all for balanced living. But if you finish strong before you go on a break, you're probably going to start the new year very well as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. So, John, let's just move on to now property investing in Australia, the current market, and perhaps just some of your ideas and strategies or philosophies around investing in residential real estate in Oz. Just to kick off, are there any particular strategies or philosophies that you've personally subscribed to when perhaps buying real estate for yourself in Australia?
Well, look, I guess there's a whole range, Dan, of things that I look at. I mean, I'm very focused on growth because I think that's where most property investors make their money over yield. Mm-hmm. I mean, yield is relevant and you need to pay your mortgage and fund all your outgoings. But, the people that I've seen have made extraordinary money from property have been those that have certainly taken a long view on property. That they're not in and out in 3 or 4 years expecting you to make a fortune because you have to ride a cycle or two if you're really going to make significant increases. And people are prepared to do the research and take calculated risks on where are the next up-and-coming spots, cities, suburbs, parts of cities, type of property. So I think that, go for growth. And respect the fact that yield is there, but I think look for capital growth is where you're going to make most of your income.
Yeah, fantastic. So that's absolutely a philosophy that many of my listeners would subscribe to. Younger audience, young professionals, very much in the accumulation phase of their investment journeys. Just on that note, for example, you've got a younger person, young professional, good income, looking to get started in the world of property investing, they're specifically after capital growth. What might be some initial advice that you'd give them to help them seek out that growth? Who should they talk to? Where should they look? That type of thing.
Well, I think you start by doing listeners by definition to this podcast. They're already researching and they're already savvy enough to know if you can put yourself in front of experts or listen to experts, you're going to get some good tips. So I think continue on that vein of researching the market, researching the opportunities, and researing the areas. Secondly is, where do you buy? I take the view that you're better to buy in areas or at least cities that you know and you can access. The only people I've ever known, Dan, that have lost money on property have been those that have bought areas they know nothing about. And I think that's a real trap. A lot of people say, well, there's this regional Queensland property and I can buy 3 bedrooms for this much and it's paying this much rental yield. The problem is if you don't know the area and that you can't service it and if anything goes wrong, it's generally going to be a bit of a trap. So I think if you're in Melbourne, try and buy in Melbourne if possible, Brisbane, Sydney, and vice versa. I think if you can do that, that's probably a great starting point.
Yeah, really interesting. Relate that, though, John, to the role of advisors. I mean, obviously, you're in a business where you've got many sales staff, and they're advising clients on a day-to-day basis. How about the role of, a buyer's advocate that may operate in across the national markets, and they might be on the ground themselves day in, day out in some of the other bigger cap city markets throughout the country? If there's a trusted relationship between client and that, say, buyer's advocate, could that be an avenue through which people could invest in interstate markets?
I think if you can find one that's incredibly good at what they do, Dan, and can be trusted, it's a great way to go. I'm not sure there are that many out there, because most advisors, be them real estate advisors, buyers, advocates, financial planners, they often are pushing their own barrow. They have a certain relationship with a type of property or a developer, and they're sometimes, encouraging you into investments that perhaps even serve them better than they're going to serve you. So I always like to keep a level of independence. I like, getting a breadth of feedback from different professionals through books and blogs and articles and podcasts and so forth. But then I think, you've got to, if you can pull this off, that is, if you can buy two or three great investment properties in your lifetime, you are set up financially forever. I don't think there is any investment. I'm sure there's no investment like property that offers the long-term growth and the security at the same time. I mean, shares are fantastic, but they can go up and down quite quickly. Of course, borrowing against shares can be a hazard in itself, whereas borrowing against property, bricks and mortar, it's stable. Banks will let you sit there through various cycles in the long term, gear it up to an appropriate amount. And I think that, if you can pull this off, so my point is, Dan, you have to do the research. Mm-hmm. And most people will make far more money from their property investments than they will from their full-time career. They're often full-time career, they're working 40 to 60 hours a week just to pay the bills. So I think you've got to put in the hard work. You've got to do all your homework to make sure that, if I'm in Melbourne, I'm in Sydney, I'm looking for where I always talk to people about Paddington in Sydney, because it's kind of quite an iconic suburb and it's now very, very popular.
That's where you started, John, your career.
Correct, exactly right. That's where I bought my first property too. And back then it was far more bohemian, and it was edgy, and it was on the way through. But I looked at it when I bought, and I've got to say there was more good luck than good management in that one, Dan, at that stage, because I was in my early 20s. And I looked at it and I said, I'd love to live here. I'd love to own a piece of real estate here. It kind of feels to me it's an interesting area for the future. So I guess I just went with my intuition there, and it paid off, because Paddington today is one of the more popular suburbs in the country. Mm-hmm. But I think the point is that if you can really work hard to identify the next Paddingtons, whether you're in Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, it doesn't matter. What are the areas? And sometimes, as I've mentioned before, you're going to have to take some calculated risks. So, what are the earmarks? What are the things you look for? I mean, for me back then, it was interesting that Paddington, it was very artistic, and I often find that creative artistic environments become very, very popular going forward. Mm-hmm. You're starting to see little art galleries and little cafes and tiny little Italian restaurants popping up in corner terraces. The gay community moved into Paddington and started renovating all the unrestored properties or unrenovated properties. And there's just a number of things that kind of felt to me like this was going to be a good area for the future. So I think if you can identify areas that are perhaps on the fringe of being fashionable but not yet in high demand, and look at investing in those areas and taking a long-term view, you're going to do exceptionally well.
Yep. No, that makes complete sense. Just so a couple of points that you've mentioned there that we can continue with. In terms of identifying some of those areas, I was just curious as to whether some of the insights that you might receive from your business with offices all around the country might give you any insights as to where some of those areas might be. Like, for example, I spoke with Charles Carby on the show, whom I know you know very well, a few months ago, and he was telling me that his Sunshine Coast office is one of his busiest. Could there be any insight similar from the McGrath info that you have that could hint at where some of these high growth markets may be moving forward?
Yeah, it's interesting Charles said that, because we also find the same. We've got four offices on the Sunshine Coast, and right at the moment they're also, you know, in very high demand, and they're growing very rapidly. It can be a little bit confusing, because sometimes depends on the quality of the operator in an office as to how well the office is going. But instance, yeah, I think it's a combination of both good operators and a good market. Look, I think, again, for a lot of people in Sydney and Melbourne have made a lot of money through their own home, and they're looking for ways of either a sea change. They're saying, well, I'm in Sydney, I've got, you know, what might be called a slightly above average house, but not spectacular. It's now worth $2.5 million. I'm 65 years of age, and a lot of people are now starting to say, well, what am I going to do if I don't need 800 square meters and $2.5 million four bedroom home? And I think some people are going to buy a smaller place in their city, and they're going to buy getaway places. They're going to work remotely. And I think areas like the Sunshine Coast will be huge beneficiaries of that trend. You could throw Gold Coast in there as well. I mean, we think the Gold Coast is very much undervalued at the moment. You know, you can buy a great two-bedroom unit near the beach on the Gold Coast for $400,000. In Sydney, that same property would be $1.2 million in the equivalent area. And I just think that value gap is too wide. So I think, you know, do that. Bearing in mind, I said, ideally, try and invest in your own city, if possible. But if you are looking to, or if you live on the Gold Coast, or if you're looking to invest outside of your area, I think Southeast Queensland, Dan, is a very good area going forward. And I'd include that triangle from the Gold Coast across to Toowoomba, and then up to the Sunshine Coast, then coming down through Brisbane. You know, we call that the Golden Triangle. And I think that with the new airport, you know, one of the other things is you've got to look for infrastructure. Where's the infrastructure being built? And how is that going to impact? So Toowoomba's had a new airport open recently in the last couple of years, and that is now allowing people to fly directly from the big cities into Toowoomba. And that is, I think, a really valuable piece of infrastructure in terms of the future property values.
So yeah, I saw that. I just saw some analysis that infrastructure spend per head in Toowoomba is now something like $26,000 per head, versus, you know, a couple of $100 in other parts of Australia, and it's specifically as a result of that airport. So it's skewing the data a little bit, but it's certainly a factor to keep in mind for investors. You know,
so when you think about it, Dan, it is no doubt skewing the data, but, you know, you go from a great city where, you know, you can still buy a beautiful home for $350,000, a house on land, you know, 200 square metre home. And then all of a sudden you go from one day you have no airport to the next day you have an airport. That is a meaningful change to the future of that particular city. So I look at that and I think, well, you know, if you can look at what other infrastructure. Now, of course, that's a citywide infrastructure, the city of Toowoomba. But you've also got areas of Sydney and Melbourne that are undergoing enormous infrastructure projects at the moment, you know, roadways, train links, light rail links. So, you know, if you're prepared to, again, do the homework, go out there and do some research, go onto the local government, state government websites, you know, draw a map of the city, put some median prices, plot them on the map, draw some of the new infrastructure. This is where I think, you know, if you've got just common sense and preparedness to do the homework, you can come out and you can say, wow, look at that little area there. You know, there's a brand new roadway that's going to be built. It's now 40 minutes from the city. It's going to be 25 minutes from the city. The median house price is, you know, 35% cheaper than, you know, a few suburbs across. So those sort of things in any city, there are definitely hints and guides that you can use. And infrastructure is definitely a good one.
Yeah, really good, really good. So John, let's come back to Melbourne and Sydney now. Having followed your work for a long time, I know that you're quite optimistic on Melbourne and Sydney. And my question was just around, you know, whether that's more a long-term view, or despite the growth that we've seen in those markets over the recent years, do you think over the short term, say the next 2 to 4 years, that we'll be seeing continued growth in Melbourne and Sydney as well?
I think Melbourne and Sydney have earned a pause. I think they're due for a bit of a breather, Dan, if I can use those terms. I don't think there's a crash at the end of it or a bubble or all the other metaphors people have used. I think that Melbourne and Sydney are really the New York of Australia. And I think if someone said to you, you know, is New York a good area to buy into? You'd say, well, it's a fantastic area if you can afford it. It's pretty expensive, but if you can actually get a foothold in New York, you know, you're set for life. I think the same can be said about Sydney and Melbourne. But I don't think you're going to see anywhere near the sort of increases that we've seen over the last few years, which have been, you know, double digit, 10 to 15% generally.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we're, you know, it's still a great area to invest for the long term. If you are looking, either if you can't afford the areas in Sydney and Melbourne that appeal, I think Brisbane is a fantastic area and the whole southeast Queensland, as I've just mentioned, great area.
Yep.
I think going forward, anyone that can own property for 10 or 20 years in Sydney or Melbourne is going to be handsomely rewarded.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, one of the mistakes that we often see with property investors is that they are in situations whereby they're forced to sell too early. And if you can't ride out that cycle, then obviously you can't see the returns. So just on that, on property cycles, John, I mean, you've been in the industry for over 30 years. You've seen many, many property cycles come and go. I was just interested in your thoughts around this current cycle and whether you feel it may be unique or different in a way. I mean, we've never had interest rates this low. We've just seen foreign investment into Australia, which has been significant, but the banks are trying to slow that now. There's a bit of uncertainty at the moment with the whole president-elect Trump, which you've spoken about on your podcast. So, I mean, do you think some of these factors might distort the current cycle in any way that as property investors we should be thinking about?
Well, it's a great question, Dan. I think that the world has changed. I think that low interest rate environment seems to be here to stay. If you look around the world and you look at the long-term money that's available, it doesn't feel like we're going to go back to the sort of interest rate regime that we had seen, you know, in previous generations overnight. I'm sure there will be a balancing up, you know, in due course. But right now, it feels like you can secure good assets with cheap money in the long term. Well, I just want to touch on, before I go on to that, just quickly said before about people being forced to sell early, and you're 100% spot on, that, you know, if you're in a situation, the only way to lose money on property, I think, is buying in areas you know nothing about, or being caught in a situation where you need to be forced to sell before the cycle's done its thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes there, it's you're unable to change that. People get divorced, you know, then an asset needs to be liquidated. I get that. But, you know, I think how you can avoid some of the other traps around that, you know, certainly don't overgear. Make sure you've got a buffer so you're not, if interest rates, for example, were to go up rapidly, which are unlikely, but if that did happen, you're not a forced seller. Buying with friends can be an issue because all of a sudden one decides to go overseas and they want to cash in their money and get out of the investment. So I think, you know, definitely, you know, one of the ways to really bulletproof your investment is to not put yourself in a position where you're likely or you may have to sell.
Yeah.
So that's the interest rate regime. So I think we're looking at low interest rates for a long, long time to come. The whole Trump factor, that's like a lottery. You don't know. I mean, I'm hoping he's going to be fantastic, although I was not a supporter, and I'm not a supporter. Now that he's in, I hope that he really shoots the lights out and he does great things for America. If not, if what I fear and I think others have feared, I guess we just have to see globally how that washes out. But, you know, again, it's a very good argument that if things do, for whatever reason, turn pear-shaped in the global economy, being in property in Australia is probably as good an asset as you can get, really. Because if things go pear-shaped and assets are a challenge, you know, share markets, as we saw during the GFC, can halve overnight. And the property values, if you're in the right place and the right type of property, I think we saw like a 12% decline in property values for short term, whereas we saw a 50% crash in share prices for medium term. So I think it's definitely an asset to be in, and I'm not trying to talk about the book because I think, you know, you need to get your own balanced advice around this, But I do think if you're looking to grow your asset base, your portfolio and your personal wealth, residential property in Australia, especially in the big cities or the growth regions, I think is a really strong strategy.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, you just mentioned the volatility difference between property and shares. I was at a debate last week. It was a shares versus property debate. And the poor guy from who was representing shares kicked off his kind of introduction by saying, you know, I got into this industry a long time ago. I started with $5,000. I turned that into $100,000 on the stock market, but then I lost it all, right? And so the guy on the property side said, oh, what'd you do? Buy property, but then take all your money and invest it in shares. You know what I mean? Like it was a bit of a jabber kind of thing. But, you know,
I think the share market is also a great way, and I think that sensible people probably have a bit of both.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do know the share market is far more volatile. And I think, you know, just good quality bricks and mortar for a community or a demographic, you've got a lot of people who are baby boomers. They're, you know, 60, 70 years of age. They're wealthy, but they want to preserve their capital. Last thing they need at 65 years of age is their capital base halving overnight. So I think property for this very big and wealthy group is going to continue to be an extremely attractive asset, as it should be. I just think it's a great long-term play.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. So, Don, just three last questions, and I'm conscious of time. I don't want to keep you for too much longer, but just three quick ones, and perhaps we can finish then. Just curious on the stock levels that we're currently seeing in Melbourne and Sydney at the moment. So, obviously, we've been in a situation where numerous sellers have been reluctant taking their properties to market, and stock levels are noticeably down. What do you think the key reasons are for that? And do you see it changing any time soon, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons. You're right. I mean, statistically, 25 to 35% less stock available, certainly established stock, not so much new stock, in the big cities, Sydney and Melbourne. But right throughout Australia, and I talk to my colleagues in the industry everywhere, everyone's saying right now no one's selling. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, I think that people have seen very aggressive growth rates and they've been sitting there saying, well, we always thought we would sell before we buy, but right now in this environment where prices are going up so quickly, we won't sell until we've bought first. Mm-hmm. So, it has been a strong period of growth and people are saying, well, if we'd have sold a year ago and hadn't bought back in, we might have been down 15%, which is a lot of money. So I think a lot of people have been fearful of the pace at which the market in the big cities has been going upwards. And I think that's sort of had them. And now, of course, it becomes self-fulfilling, Dan, that if enough people say, well, we're not going to sell until we buy, then nothing comes on the market and then no one can buy because no one's selling. I think that's an issue. The second thing is I think just general affordability in moving at the moment. A lot of people have said, you know, my $1 million house is now worth 1.5. Stamp duty to buy the next home, which has now gone up from 1.5 to 2 million.
Yeah.
4%, that's a lot of money. Selling fees on 1.5 now feels like it's a lot when you combine it to stamp duty, et cetera, et cetera. So I think people in the short term are looking at the cost of moving and some of them are thinking, well, maybe we renovate, maybe we extend, maybe we wait a little while till the market calms down. So I think, you know, it's a combination. That's predominantly anecdotal. I have nothing other than conversations, dinner party conversations, intuition, talking to my agents to go on. But it feels to me they are probably the two reasons there's been less stock.
Do you see that changing, like coming into next year?
Well, look, I think so, because I think Sydney and Melbourne are coming into that breather that I spoke about. So people have less reason to be fear of being caught out of the market and more reason to be expecting, well, this is a more traditional time, and if I sell and it takes me 6 months to find something, there's no great issue because I'm not going to lose 5 or 10% of my value. Excuse me. So I think... that's happening now. With regard to the cost of moving, I don't think that's going away in a hurry. I think the state governments are addicted to the stamp duty, I think the reason a lot of the infrastructure is happening and a lot of the books have been balanced recently is because the stamp duty inflows have been unparalleled. And so I think right now, people, it's just a matter of people getting used to the fact that it's going to cost a bit of money. I mean, we've you know, sort of been quite vocal, as have the REIs, in discussing with state governments finding ways to reduce the cost of transferring from one home to the other.
Yeah.
Because, of course, yeah, I mean, whilst they do get a big chunk of money, I mean, if people stop selling, then they're going to lose that revenue. And the other associated industries, and I'm not just talking about real estate here, I'm talking about renovations and architects and removalists and repairs and maintenance companies and a whole range of solicitors and accountants, whole range of business is you know, benefits from a healthy flow of people doing what they do, which is moving around and one home to the next, and they upgrade and they renovate, they make a bit of money, they move to the next one. It's actually been a really good part of the Australian wealth creation cycle. So hopefully the state governments may look at that. I mean, at the other end of the scale, there's that insanity of doubling. I think it's insanity of doubling the stamp duty for foreign buyers, which I think is a craziness beyond crazy. I just look at that and I think, wow, in an environment of global village globalization and the world now kind of relies on each and every one of us, and no longer do we kind of live in little islands and silos. We're part of a global economy, and to really get rid of all the overseas investors by saying, well, it's not 4% stamp duty, it's now 8 or 9, I think that's a terrible disincentive for overseas investment in this great country.
Yeah.
So that'd be my other thing, would be, I think that, you know, hopefully sanity prevails and they remove that. And in the meantime, I hope they have a look at some of the transactional costs. You know, really rubber stamping, stamp duty, 4%, is just, you get no value for it. There's been bracket creep. You know, we did a little thing the other day with the Real Estate Institute. We were looking at the cost of, you know, 20, 30 years ago property and the stamp duty. Well, stamp duty's gone up like 35 times and the property values have gone up 10 times. Because there's been no change to the tiers at which stamp duty kicks in. So it's really, I think, at the moment needs some adjustment so people aren't hit so hard every time they decide to move.
It is interesting. I mean, there have been talks, haven't there, around like, you know, different property and land taxes to kind of compensate for potentially reducing some of those transaction costs, but we haven't actually seen any action there yet. And then just going back to your point around the self-fulfilling prophecies and whatnot, if you know, we do see some more stock obviously coming onto the market next year, that could also be self-fulfilling in a way, because with the larger supply of stock as a result of people being more perhaps willing to re-enter the market, that's the type of thing that could soften the market just as a result of the larger supply.
No doubt. And I think down that will happen together. You know, the market starts, you know, sort of less aggressive and then more property comes on. So that, again, it calms the market down a bit more.
Yeah.
So instead of going to an auction and there's 37 registered bidders, there might be 6, you know, which is kind of a more, you know, sort of traditional number, even a healthy market, you know. But if you've got 4, 5, or 6 registered bidders, well, that's good. Good property should be contested. I think it's interesting times, but I do think we will see more stock coming to the market from next January onwards.
Yeah, really good. All right, John. So just lastly then, mate, you know, obviously you've built a fantastic company in McGrath Estate Agents. It's one of the iconic brands in the real estate industry. You know, so much to be so proud of there. Just curious as to your thoughts or any suggestions for investors in the context of, you know, building an investment portfolio is very much akin to building a small business of your own, trying to, you know, buy one property and as that grows in values, buy the next and build and grow from there. So just any thoughts around, like, with your experience having built McGrath's, that might inspire some of our listeners or give them some handy hints in building their small property investment businesses?
Yeah, look, I think you're right. They're a bit the same. Some of my philosophies on business that would be relevant to investors would be keep it very simple. Mm-hmm. Do your homework and surround yourself with the best talent and the best people and advisors as you can. Now, whether you're building a business or a property portfolio, I think that's probably sage advice. So
yep.
As we mentioned earlier, Dan, you know, if you can find your way to build a portfolio of three or four properties, good quality properties in metropolitan regions that have got good growth prospects, you know, you'll set yourself and your family and future generations indeed up for life. So you know, put the effort in. Realise that the reward is significant if you get it right. And there's no reason nowadays you shouldn't get it right. There's so much information available through podcasts like this and through the internet. So I think, you know, do your homework. If your accountant says, oh, you know, you can afford to go out there and buy a property and whatever, negatively gear it, well, you know, don't be cavalier about it. Don't just go and buy the first available thing and, you know, really do some research. And if you can find the next Paddington, and you can find the right property in that area. And what is the right property? Well, it's a property that feels different, special. Dan, one of the things often I disagree with, you know, investors that, or investor kind of advisors that say, well, you're not buying it for yourself, so don't look at it as such your own home. Mm-hmm. I think you actually look at it as though it's a home that would you like to live in, or would you like your kids to live in, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Find something that's a bit special. Because in 10 years' time or 20 years' time, when you choose to sell it, you actually want the stuff that made it feel special. You want that stuff to still be there. So I think, yeah, go and do the research. I mean, property is one of those wonderful industries that there's information aplenty, and you can go out there and become, you know, fairly expert fairly quickly.
Yep. Very good, very good. I mean, there's definitely so much overlap. I even think just in the context of me listening to your podcast, I'm not in the real estate industry as such. I'm certainly not an agent, but, you know, I listen to your podcast each week, and there's so much benefits and insights that help me as a property investor and as a mortgage broker. And, you know, definitely, I think for people to just find good mentors, and like you say, they don't have to be people that you know. They can be people that you can find on YouTube and Google and podcasts and the internet to learn from and grow with. It is very sage business advice that relates well to investing in property. So John, thanks so much for your time. Any final thoughts or comments before we end the show?
No, the only comment, I'm so glad I got through without spluttering too much all over your audience. Maybe we can sort of revisit in a year or so and see where the market's gone. It'd be a real pleasure to speak to you again, Dan.
I'd love to do that, John. All right, well, you have a good day. Best of luck getting over the cough, and best of luck to the end of 2016 as we follow in closely.
Thank you and your listeners. Thanks, Dan.
All right, have a good day. Thanks, John. Bye.